Bye.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. And as it's Thursday, we're continuing with our Ballot Talk series here on Radio Times. We're tackling three subjects this hour: how social media shapes modern-day politics, also Philadelphia is getting its cigarette tax, what the political ramifications of that might be. But first, many people who've spent time in Pennsylvania's prison system do not exercise their right to vote upon release. And Jandai Harrell has organized a movement to encourage ex-offenders to register to vote in the November election. Jandai Harrell is founder of the Center for Returning Citizens Philadelphia, and he joins us in studio for Radio Times. Welcome.
Thank you. How are you doing this morning?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. Let's talk briefly about your story, Jandai. You yourself were incarcerated at one point.
Yes, I was incarcerated. I served two federal sentences. I've served a total of 25 years incarcerated.
And so how long since you've been released?
Well, I came home in September 2009. I don't really count the first 6 months because I was still incarcerated. I was in a halfway house system. But on April the 1st, 2010, I was totally released from federal custody, and I began my work that I had really started many years previously while I was incarcerated. I actually started preparing for my release in the second year of my incarceration. I did a 18-year sentence on a 20-year bank robbery charge.
So as you made your way back into society, were you thinking about the next election?
Well, basically when I first came home, I was kind of shocked to find out that I could vote as soon as I came home. I went to apply for my driver's license, and while I was doing that, the lady said, "Would you like to register to vote?" And a light bulb went off my head, and I said, "Yes, I would." And I registered to vote, and at that point, I began to investigate, and I realized that Pennsylvania is one of the few states where formerly incarcerated individuals can vote as soon as they get out of prison.
It does vary from state to state.
Yes.
The reason I asked the earlier question is because it seems that so many people who are just out of prison are just trying to get to the next step, a job, a place to stay, food on the table. Is that your experience?
Yes, most definitely. When you first come home, a job is the foundation of what you're trying to do, and then housing. Even though I was supremely prepared for reentry, it was still very rocky. I had an 18-year gap in my job resume. The world had changed. Even though you think you are prepared for the street, it's very difficult. And while I was incarcerated, I'd earned my associate's degree. I came home, earned my bachelor's, and I'm in a master's degree program of social work at Temple University. So I was able to transition smoothly, but I realized that many other people might have difficulties. So we formed the Center for Returning Citizens to help people to have a smooth transition.
So how many people have joined the TCRC?
Well, right now we have about 450 clients in our Center City office and about 274 in our Germantown Avenue office.
So characterize for us why it is so important that ex-convicts vote as part of their efforts to reenter society.
Well, at the TCRC, our slogan is transformation and transition. We believe that in order for you to transition smoothly, you have to transform your thinking. You have to get away from a criminal mentality. And one of the reasons that we champion the phrase returning citizen is you have to return to a full state of citizenship. In order to do that, you have to vote. So many returning citizens want to complain about how society is structured, how it's very difficult to transition, how there aren't enough jobs, and there aren't enough real programs to assist us. Well, instead of complaining about it, you have to be proactive. You have to register to vote. You have to support politicians that are inclined toward our needs and necessities and move forward in that way.
As you mentioned a little bit earlier, it varies from state to state, the right to vote upon release from prison. In New Jersey, voting rights are restored after incarceration has ended and parole or probation are over.
Yes.
Is that a fair deal, in your opinion?
I don't think it's a fair deal. What it's saying is that even though you're home, you are still not a part of society. What we have to look at is that formerly incarcerated individuals are often relegated to second-class citizenship status. In New Jersey, you're not really a citizen if you can't vote. Also, even in Pennsylvania, we can't serve on juries. There are many things that we can't do, but in Pennsylvania, we can vote. So that's the beginning of trying to form a society that is more beneficial for returning citizens. What we are trying to do through the Block Party, which stands for Build, Lobby, Organize, and Campaign, is to create a movement that empowers returning citizens. According to University of Pennsylvania statistics, there are between 250 and 300,000 returning citizens in the city of Philadelphia. What that means is we can effectively organize, we can be a voting bloc more powerful than any other voting bloc currently in the city.
So, and I was just going to say, the word bloc, as in block party, actually also comes from cell block?
Yes. Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about this block party. You're organizing it for Saturday. Where and what are you doing to get the word out to the ex-offender population?
Well, the block party rally is going to be Saturday, September 27th at 5800 Germantown Avenue in Vernon Park. Vernon Park is located on right off of Germantown Avenue, one block above Shelton Avenue, in between Germantown and Green Avenues. It's a huge park, and we have the entire park for the day from 1 to 6.
And so what will be happening there? Will there be information? Will there be actually opportunities to register there?
Yes. We have 3,000 voter registration forms that we got from the city government. We're going to be registering folks to vote. Not only are we going to be registering folks to vote, but we're asking registered voters to come out and sign up to be a part of the block party. In order for us to influence city government, state government, we have to show that we have enough voters so that they consider our platform. And we have a platform. If you go online at tcrcphilly.org, you'll see the block party platform. And
well, go ahead, finish your thought.
And what we're trying to do is have people come out so that we can attain numbers. In order for us to move the block party forward, we have to be able to show politicians that we have a viable voting block and have names, numbers, addresses. These are our people, and we're all going to vote in the same direction.
So, John Dye, you call people who are released from prison returning citizens.
Yes.
And yet society views them as ex-convicts.
Ex-convicts, formerly incarcerated. You know, there's a lot of terms used, and most of them use the word X and refer to our past. We're focused on the fact that we have paid our debt to society, we have transformed our minds and our lives, and we want to be a viable part of society. So we are citizens that are not only returning to a state of freedom, but returning to a state of citizenship, which many of us have not properly used in the past.
So do you think, we'll talk about what's in a name here, do you think that terminology could actually help to reduce recidivism?
I really do, because how you think of yourself, how you view yourself, how you move forward in life often is determined by not only how others see you, but how you see yourself. When you empower yourself with a term, returning citizen, you are saying, I'm returning to society, I'm a viable part of society, this is what I'm going to do. Part of the TCRC philosophy is also atonement for the things you've done in the past. Many of us have seriously injured our neighborhoods, our family, and our community, and society in general. We are looking to atone for that, to build in the community, and to do many things that are beneficial.
And yet you say TCRC isn't for everyone.
Well, TCRC isn't for everyone because many people who are coming home from prison are not yet in a state of consciousness where they are ready to make that move. Oftentimes, I'll speak to young men in my office, on the street, other places. I will listen to their commentary, and I'll say, okay, brother, in reality, you aren't at a point yet where you're really trying to change. Maybe.
How do you sense that? Well, what are they saying?
It's apparent. I mean, if, all right, many times people come home from prison, and the expectations of their family and for themselves are one thing, but it's very difficult. if you're trying to do the right thing and you don't have money, you're looking at a minimum wage job, you can't move in the same way that you used to before. Most folks who are involved in crime and were fairly successful at it have had money. Now when you come home, it's extremely difficult to do things the right way and to make money and move forward. So after a while, a lot of people get tired and they start to slip back into old patterns of thinking and old patterns of behavior.
And to them you say what?
What I say is, this is the way you have to go. You have to struggle and you have to move forward. But oftentimes they aren't willing to do that. So if they aren't willing to do that, sometimes they have to bump their heads a couple more times until they wake up. You know, I literally tell guys, after your next sentence, come back and see us. We'll still be here. And that's the reality. And we deal with reality at TCRC.
I've read that you keep the pair of shoes you purchased in prison.
Yes, they're on my, I have a little second bedroom, which is like a clothing room, and they're on the shelf. And as soon as I walk in that bedroom, they're right there on the shelf. And they remind me every day of what I went through. Those are the shoes that I walked in the yard with, you know, that I walked through the library that I worked in every day. And when I see them, I'm reminded of all the years that I spent inside. And it's important to have that reminder so that you never slip into patterns of behavior that are detrimental to yourself, your family, and your community.
So, John Dye, was there a moment in prison when things changed for you?
Well, I think that, you know, things really began to change in my mind when Judge Dubois gave me a 20-year sentence. I mean, I'd never received a sentence that long, and under federal law, you got to do 85% of your sentence. So at that moment in time, I'm looking at 18 years minimum in prison, which is an amazing assault on your mind. So at that point, I'm saying to myself, my life is in ruins. My family is in ruins. How am I going to change this and move forward into the future? And it really took me about a year of a contemplation, really looking at myself in a hard, cold light and saying, how am I going to change this? That's what I decided to do, was to align myself with all of the conscious, educated, forward-moving elements in the prison. And from that point on, begin to transform how I thought and how I acted.
So we only have about 30 seconds left. What is next for you and TCRC?
Well, what is next for us is to continue to organize the block party. I'd like to encourage everyone to come out to Vernon Park. If you are a returning citizen, especially, but if you are a community member who wants to see your block change, we're not just talking about those who are in the cell block. We're talking about the community blocks. If you're tired of the violence, if you're tired of turning on the news and seeing school kids get shot, then you need to come out to the block party and help us move forward.
John Dye Harrell, thank you so much for joining us. John Dye Harrell is founder of the Center for Returning Citizens, Philadelphia. Up next, looks like Philadelphia will get a cigarette tax in an effort to salvage the school year. Will this help Governor Corbett in his reelection bid? WHYY's education reporter Kevin McCrory will be along. Stay with us.
Zollner Arts Center at Lehigh University supports WHYY and presents the Princeton Singers, Sunday, September 28th. The Dream Concert, a 30th anniversary celebration, recognized as one of the premier professional chamber choirs in the country. Tickets at zollerartscenter.org.
The Executive MBA at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY and is proud to announce the Executive MBA's relocation to the Hub Commerce Square at 20th and Market Streets in Center City, Philadelphia. In only one weekend per month for 16 months, the Executive MBA is designed to help you expand your leadership and business skills needed to succeed in a complex global economy. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/EMBA.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Move over Motown. There is new music out of Detroit from singer-songwriter Sheila Brody.
It's gritty, funk, soul with a little bit of hip-hop in it and just amazing urban feel.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Hi, I'm Jerry McGinnis, managing partner for KPMG Philadelphia. Our audit, tax, and advisory professionals are passionate about turning knowledge into value to benefit our clients and the capital markets we serve. More at kpmg.com. KPMG supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. On Tuesday, several weeks after the start of the school year, the Philadelphia School District received the news it had been waiting for. Pennsylvania lawmakers had finally agreed on legislation implementing a tax of $2 per pack of cigarettes sold in Philadelphia. It had been a long and sometimes torturous road. What might this mean politically for those who are on board and who are up for election or re-election? And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-888-477-9499. WHYY's education reporter Kevin McCrory joins us. Nice to see you again, Kevin.
You too, Mary.
So Governor Corbett moved quickly. He signed the cigarette tax into law. He is running for re-election, obviously, trying to burnish his reputation as far as education is concerned. At this point, still behind Tom Wolf in the polls. What is the general perception as to whether Corbett signing this into law will help his campaign?
Well, I guess that's going to depend on what region we're talking about, right, Mary? So in Philadelphia, it's definitely seen as a very positive thing that this bill has been passed for the schools. You know, you can question whether or not that's going to make up some of the feelings that people have about his overall education positions and the actions that he has or hasn't taken over the past 4 years. Maybe if you get out to the suburbs, people who are not as close to the Philadelphia situation, they might see this as, you know, a good thing. And maybe if they were on the fence, they think, you know, this could be, you know, carry him good favor. In other, you know, more tax averse, you know, really strong Republican districts, this could be seen as Corbett kind of caving. Remember, he came in on a Tea Party wave. He had a no tax pledge. So now here he is, you know, celebrating this tax. And that could be seen as, you know, a downside for him. But what, you know, does that mean they're going to go and vote for Tom Wolf? Probably not. But maybe it means they're not going to get out to vote at all. So we'll see, I guess, how that affects it. So it's going to affect him depending on where the location is. But I think it's important, too, to take a step back and think about how this politically unfolded since the end of June. And in the, you know, when June came along and the state's budget was being put together and we saw how much revenue was there and how much wasn't there, it became apparent that there was going to be some appetite possibly for new revenues. And at the time, Corbett and a number of Republicans held the position that there was going to be, you know, some sort of quid pro quo here for giving the Philadelphia School District this money. Mm-hmm. And they, and Corbett specifically and his administration was, I think, going to make a play, and they were vocal in this, for trying to get pension reform. Mm-hmm. And if they could get pension reform and the Philadelphia cigarette tax, now that would be a huge legislative victory for him, and that would, you know, be part of his legacy. And they were very vocal about wanting to get, you know, Philadelphia and southeastern Pennsylvania Democrats on board with a pension reform in exchange for Republican votes and his signage of a cigarette tax bill. That you know, that didn't happen.
Yeah,
that did not, you know, go through the wash with those southeastern Democrats. And as the pressure mounted for, you know, the schools really need this money, our school's going to open, that's when you saw Corbett and a lot of those folks back away from that quid pro quo. And he came out and said, no, pass a clean bill. Let's get this done. Because I think he saw the writing on the wall. Because if this doesn't get passed next week, the week after, we're talking about the Philadelphia School District, if they had opened at all, laying off another 1,000 employees.
Sure.
And then that's just going to dominate the news cycle until the election.
In a negative
and that's
way,
that's
sure.
going to be completely bad for him. So it was important, I think he realized, to get it done. And then he was, you know, an advocate and a vocal advocate for it in the last 2 months of the conversation.
All right, let's talk about the tax itself. It's supposed to funnel money into a terribly underfunded district. What is it, an $81 million gap?
Well, at this point, there's not a gap, right? Because
they've got the schools open, but they're short.
Right. They've made cuts to make up for that gap.
Yeah.
So and then the cigarette tax was a placeholder that they were counting on, and so now that's coming through, as long as it generates the money that they think it's going to generate, which they're estimating at $49 million this year, then that gap is closed. And that's another thing that we should say with this tax. Hey, you know, it's a victory, it's a legislative win, but let's remember that this is only part of a budget that's getting us back to the status quo for what schools had last year.
Is there a sense that that $49 million is overly optimistic?
Let's put it this way. The city's estimations would be much higher. And there's other lowball estimations out there. And what the district did is essentially pick the number in the middle. So if you think that the city's estimations were overly optimistic, you know, maybe you think, okay, this could work out, for what the district's budgeting because it's below that. Some might say, yeah, it's even too optimistic still because, you know, we're going to have surges in black markets or people are just going
to cross the border.
Bucks County or Jersey or Delaware. Sure. That is all built in. Those things are all built into the formula that both the city is using and the district is using.
Okay.
So those concerns, you know, could be there, but the people who are making these decisions say they've been taken account for.
So when does the city actually start seeing this money?
Well, it'll go to the district as soon as the tax is collected. The most recent conversations that the state has had about that is that it could ramp up in as soon as 5 days. So it was signed yesterday. It could be in stores next week. Whether that is overly optimistic for a ramp-up time, I guess we'll see. But that's one of the things that Corbett did over the summer was say, well, the only thing I can do until the legislature passes it is get the higher administrative things in order. And I've instructed the Treasury to make sure this tax is collected as fast as possible. So you have to trust that that's going to happen, I suppose, and then the money will start flowing in. And the key is that the district is they're not going to be living and dying week to week, necessarily, in the beginning at least, for how much is coming in. They're going to count on that figure being reached, and they'll be closely monitoring it. And then, yeah, if it's falling way below projections, they'll find other things to cut. But I doubt it's going to have to be a drastic slate of layoffs as it would have been if it wasn't passed at all.
Okay. So, Kevin, there were lawmakers both in and outside of the city. We talked about that a little bit earlier, who helped to get this tax passed. Curious as to know why the firm support from outside of Philadelphia.
Well, yeah, this tax
doesn't. And many were Republicans.
Right. This tax doesn't get passed without suburban outlying districts of Philadelphia Republicans. Those are the people who, got this into the faces of the leadership of the GOP, which in the House is especially not at all from Philadelphia, and who at first were very averse to this tax. Let's even take a step back and remember that the Philadelphia City Council passed this tax in spring of 2013. Mm-hmm. So it sits 2013 all the way into 2014 and comes around here. So it's not like people were in a hurry to get this done until it needed to.
Yeah.
And you could argue that it really needed to get done last year because schools didn't have the resources they needed last year. But I digress there. The question of why they would be on board, I think they see, what's the cost of educating 200,000 kids in Philadelphia? It's by far the biggest district in the state. They're up close and personal with the issues. They're hearing them every day, and they're realizing that they gotta stick their necks out and get this done, even if it means stepping up to the House leadership and saying, you're opposed to this right now. Well, these are the reasons we need to get it done. So it was people like Bill Adolph, who's a Delaware County Republican. Mm-hmm. People like Mike Verib, who's a Montgomery County Republican.
Who's up for re-election?
He is up for re-election. It was also people specifically like John Taylor, Philadelphia's lone Republican in the delegation, his support. And the other little piece of political calculation you can say is that it probably doesn't pass at all without an amendment that he tacks onto the bill, which simply put makes it easier for someone who wants to create a new charter school to get approved. As is now, if the School Reform Commission rejects your plea, it's rejected, and they don't even have to hear it to begin with. So this amendment says you have to hear it, and then if it's rejected, there's an appeals process that goes to a state board, and that state board might be more charter friendly, or it might not understand the district's finances or the district's reasons as well. But at least that amendment in there was something that, Taylor told me personally that without that, there was people from, districts far away from Philadelphia who probably wouldn't have cared to vote for the bill, but at least here was something that they saw as maybe an accountability measure.
Sure. You've written in your work that opponents worry this could lead to unfettered charter expansion.
Right. Well, I guess the question is who is applying for these charters, and are they going to be serving the students of Philadelphia equitably, and are they going to be adhering to maybe enrollment caps, and if they're not, you know, are they going to be over-enrolling people and trying to get the state to pay the money? And it just comes down to the fact that a large portion of the district's costs do go to charter payments, and that the money doesn't literally follow the child, right? It's not like if you take one kid out of a district school and put them in a charter school, the expense is completely carried over. There's, you know, these things that they call stranded costs, and they add up with more students. So, you know, there are some advocates who fear that that could happen, and that could be disastrous to the district's budget. But I think the real fear, and especially when you talk to the district, is who is getting authorized as a charter school. And if they're really good options, great. But if they're not serving students and serving students equitably, there's concern there.
Kevin, we have an email from Rianne. She says, regarding the cigarette tax, who will this tax affect? It seems that those paying the $2 tax will be the poor in Philadelphia.
Well, it's smokers. You know, I don't know if I can come out and say that, you know, if you smoke, you're poor. But I think that the numbers probably do bear that out to some extent. We talk about legislative or political wins. I mean, this is a political win for the Nutter administration as well, who, you know, has you know, made it a target for them for these sort of things. You know, their sugary beverage tax didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So now here's the cigarette tax that does happen. And, you know, you talk to the Department of Public Health in Philadelphia, and they'll say that this is a huge public health slam dunk. This is going to send smoking rates down. This is going to save money in healthcare costs. So aside from the school angle, aside from the money angle, they will say that that's a victory there. But, you know, to the emailer's point, yeah. Here's money going to the Philadelphia School District on the backs of the Philadelphia smokers who maybe demographically are low-income residents.
Okay. Yeah. And if smoking rates go down, of course, there's not as much money coming in.
Right. So, I mean, that's all built into that the money will decrease over time. But it is recurring revenue, at least, where a lot of the revenue we've seen in recent years is a one-time influx. Mm-hmm. So it comes in and everybody celebrates it. But then as soon as the district has to do its next budget, the hole gets even bigger.
Yeah.
And it's, well, because that one-time revenue went away. So at least this is something that they can count on for years to come.
Let's get back to Mayor Nutter for a moment. Assuming that the city is no longer caught in a vortex of political hell, as he famously said over the summer, I think he, as you wrote earlier this week, expressed restrained enthusiasm. Restrained enthusiasm.
Sure. And that's the other thing. So everybody will celebrate this and is celebrating this because, like I said, without it, there would be another huge slate of layoffs. But again, it's only getting close to status quo from last year. And again, people will say we need a fair, equal student-weighted funding formula. And the fact that that's not happening, you know, we can't be overly enthusiastic about this tax passing. And then, there's a slate of other ideas for how to generate revenue that people say without a big increase into Philadelphia schools, you know, is not going to really put students on a path that they need to be and give them the resources that they really need. So he's, you know, one of a chorus of, I'd say, every Democratic politician in this city who is not going to say that, okay, we've made it. They're saying this is great. We needed this. Mm-hmm. Sure. But if we want to get serious about what schools need, we're going to have to do a lot more.
Sure. So let's be clear. This cigarette tax is or is not going to help to bring back nurses, counselors, librarians to the Philadelphia School
District.
Not
at all. Not at all. Yeah.
Okay, that's clear. So what will it take? What is the next step to restore some of these vital elements to the district?
Well, that's where I guess we get into the conversation about other big revenue generators. Yeah. And there's been talk of, you know, natural gas severance tax, obviously, whether or not that happens under a Tom Wolf administration or a Corbett administration, that certainly could drive more money to schools. It's things like reinstating the charter reimbursement line that Corbett cut in his first budget. That would do a lot of help for a district like Philadelphia, which has a lot of charter schools in it. There's a lot of other ideas out there, you know, expanding Medicaid the way the federal government had wanted. People estimate that would generate a lot more money for schools. So there's a lot of ideas out there. How those things actually get accomplished under a Wolf or a Corbett regime with the legislature as it's voted into office in November. I mean, those are huge political lifts for these things to happen. As we saw with this tax, with this measure, we're talking about giving Philadelphia the opportunity to tax itself. And it took this much effort to get the state to go along with that. So, you know, there's big political moves ahead and a lot of work to do if schools are going to get more funding.
Back to the cigarette tax law.
Sure.
There is a sunset provision?
Right. So this was something that was added. Let's do a little dance here, right? So if I remember correctly, the Senate passes it, then the House gets it, and changes it and passes it. So it goes back to the Senate. And so it's at that second time that the Senate's about to pass it again that they insert this sunset provision, which essentially means in 5 years, they get to decide whether or not it completely goes away. And why was that added the second time when it wasn't there the first time? Well, Democrats in Philadelphia were saying the tobacco lobby started to realize that this thing could happen, and they ramped up some sort of fight against it. And in the negotiation there, this was the thing that came out, this 5-year sunset provision. And
nobody's paying attention to that right now, I'm assuming, in terms of planning for the school budget or thinking about it.
I would say that the district leaders probably are, because as soon as that happened, Superintendent Height came out and said, this undercuts our ability to plan long term. You know, we would absolutely not like this to be there, but it seemed like it had to be there to get the support and the votes, so it went along. For instance, the person who authored and sponsored the original cigarette tax legislation is State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams, and he was in this committee that was voting on whether or not that sunset provision would be attached, and he voted for it. And I talked to him afterwards because people were angry at him when that happened. And he said, well, it wasn't going to go without it. If I felt like I was going to be the deciding vote, I probably would have voted against it. But the fact that it was going to pass anyway, this was my gesture of political goodwill towards the thing passing in general. So there's a lot of those little behind the scenes
nuances
that happen.
Sure. So in the remaining minute or so that we have left, sure, Let's get back to Tom Wolf for a moment. Should he end up in the governor's office, what is your sense of how things might or might not change for the Philadelphia School District?
His priorities are going to be closely aligned with what the district, I think, would want and what parents in Philadelphia would want as far as resources in schools. But it's, going to be a tremendous challenge for him to be able to get some of those things done, especially if, as it seems like it will be, the legislature remains controlled by Republicans in both the House and Senate, who, as we said, are, typically very tax averse. And even getting this tax through, which only affects Philadelphians, was this hard to accomplish. So, Wolf is going to be faced with a lot of challenges. And I guess the question would be, is he politically savvy enough? Is he going to be able to pull those levers as a guy who hasn't been an elected politician to really get those things through? He, of course, says he will, but
stay tuned.
There's doubters, yeah.
Kevin McCrory, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you, Mary.
Kevin McCrory is WHYY's education reporter. And just ahead on our Ballot Talks edition of Radio Times, we'll look at how social media shapes modern political campaigns with Daniel Kreese, assistant professor at UNC Chapel Hill. That's coming right up. And if you'd like to join the conversation, again, the number is 1-888-477-9499, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Delaware's resident ensemble players support WHYY and present the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning play Angels in America. Millennium approaches now through October 12th. This epic drama is a provocative, witty, and moving account of a circle of friends in the 1980s whose lives are shattered by the emerging AIDS crisis. Jewish, Mormon, gay, straight, black, and white. None are untouched by the impending storm. 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
Get them early, get them often.
If I don't get an education, I'll be stuck like my parents. But I haven't always been able to make school my priority.
The race to intervene with young people before poverty becomes destiny. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center is a proud supporter of WHYY. One of the newest advances in the fight against cancer is immunotherapy, a treatment that unleashes your body's own immune system so it can better fight cancer cells. Early results from studies at Fox Chase Cancer Center and other cancer centers show promise, even in patients who did not respond to other treatments. Learn more at 888-FOX-CHASE or foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, part of Temple Health, your first choice in cancer care.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. And as always, you're welcome to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. If you use social media, we'd love to hear what you think about our final segment this hour. We're going to look at how social media has shaped the modern-day political campaign. Our guest is Daniel Kreese, Assistant Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at UNC Chapel Hill, and he joins us from the UNC Chapel Hill studio. Welcome to Radio Times.
Great. Thanks, Mary. Great to be here.
So let's look at Facebook first. Facebook is increasingly being used as a tool by campaigns to get people into the voting booth. How does that work, Daniel?
Sure. Well, I think campaigns really over the last, since 2008, have been looking at Facebook as a tool for ways that they can reach their voters and engage with them and try to turn them out. I think one of the things we saw in 2008 was the Obama campaign in particular setting up lots of Facebook groups for places like colleges and high schools and trying to get folks to join those groups and then having online organizers basically turn them out. And then in 2012, I think you've really seen sort of the boom in advertising online. As one of the campaigners who I've been interviewing for my forthcoming book said, they didn't really believe they could compete with Facebook or Twitter. It was all about sort of where their supporters were going in the morning when they woke up. What were they checking first? So they wanted to be on Facebook and having ads and having supporters talking about the campaign so that they could reach them that way.
Let's get into a little history regarding social media and campaigns. We'll explore this a little further. Back to 2004, the presidential campaign, Democrat Howard Dean is making a run for the nomination, and there are a lot of young technological types working for his campaign. Take it from there.
Sure. Yeah. So I think one of the big stories about digital media and politics and innovation is that campaigns tend to be innovative when they attract talent from outside the political field and then bring them over and couple them with professionals who work in the political field, and then all sorts of new recombinations happen. So one of the things about Howard Dean's run is that it got a lot of attention and a lot of folks sort of left high-tech jobs. Folks with technology skills sort of came over and they wanted to see how technologies could be applied in electoral context to improve democracy and ultimately to power Dean's run. And of course, Dean didn't win that race, but it was very interesting because a lot of the people who came together on his campaign stayed in politics, and they created a number of very influential firms, one of which, Blue State Digital, went on and provided lots of the tools and technologies for the Democratic Party after Dean became chair in 2005. And then they ended up providing the platform and a lot of the staffers for Obama's 2008 run and then again in 2012. And on the Republican side of the aisle, it was interesting because George Bush's campaign, re-election campaign, I think doesn't get the credit it deserves for a lot of the online precinct captain programs they were doing and integration between the organizing that was taking shape online and in field campaigning. But it was a really remarkable campaign in its own right. And lots of folks who joined that bid went on to the party, Republican Party, after the president's re-election victory. And I think on the Republican side, what you see now is sort of a new big investment after 2012 in terms of digital, social media and data.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that in just a moment. So 2004 was the year social media technology really began to shape and influence campaigns. And then in 2007, there was a groundbreaking YouTube video aimed at Hillary Clinton, a so-called citizen ad.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the general story there is, and this field changes so much. So what you have in 2004 is there is no YouTube. And one of the stories of politics really
it's hard to believe.
Is, right. I know. And how campaigns try to keep pace. I mean, just to give you one example, in 2012 alone, you basically had a host of new platforms. So Spotify, Pinterest, Instagram, Google Hangouts, none of those existed during the 2008 election. And in fact, one of the other big stories of 2012 is the fact that Twitter had emerged really for the first time. The tweet announcing the Obama campaign's victory in 2008 was retweeted 157 times in 2008. And in fact, when I interviewed folks who did digital media on both the Obama campaigns, one of the things they said to me was they probably had an intern or something doing Twitter in 2008. By 2012, the Obama sort of reelect picture was retweeted over 800,000 times just in 3 days. So the spectacular growth of those program of those platforms was really a big story of politics. And in 2007, right, so there was no YouTube strategy 4 years earlier. And then all of a sudden in 2007, you see lots of user-produced, citizen-produced video ads aimed at particular candidates. There was a number during that time that went viral, either against Hillary Clinton or pro-Hillary Clinton. The Obama campaign used YouTube very effectively to drive lots of campaign messages out, but also just disseminate the candidate's speeches. And it became really for the first time a really large part of campaigning in a very impactful way.
So I was under the impression that the Republican Party was keeping up with this, but it seems that social media did play a pivotal role in Barack Obama's presidential win in 2008. Is that too strong a statement?
Yeah, I think the general story and the way that I like to think about this is that it provides a marginal competitive advantage, which
okay,
is
marginal.
To say there's there's a lot of things that shape election outcomes, and political scientists have been doing great work sort of teasing that out. I mean, so the state of the economy, how the incumbent party is viewed. There's all sorts of issues relating to turnout and partisan identification, et cetera. But what I think social media does is sort of enable campaigns to much more efficiently connect with their supporters, help turn them out to the polls, raise money. And then really, I think social media has become part of the basic fabric through which people actually consume media content today. And that's an important driver of the story, in that I think people are increasingly getting political information from social media. People are increasingly consuming news content, particularly younger generations, through social media instead of going to homepages of news outlets. So I think campaigns are sort of changing their strategies and tactics to reflect the realities of the change in media habits and media practices among the citizenry today.
So just in looking at the evolution of the role social media plays, let's talk about the campaign in 2008 of John McCain and then the campaign in 2012 of Mitt Romney. Were the GOP campaigns on par with what the Democrats were doing at the time as far as social media was concerned?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think most commentators and political practitioners would say that there was a gap between the 2008 Obama campaign and the 2008 McCain campaign. And then that gap persisted through 2012. And I think in 2008, one of the big parts of the story was that it was really an unfavorable electoral context for John McCain. I think you had a very unpopular incumbent Republican president. There was lots of energy and mobilization behind the Obama campaign that really and they made a lot of very adept use, I think, of social media to turn out their supporters and engage with their supporters, et cetera. I think 2012, you actually saw a gap as well. And I think that gap is complicated to explain, but there were a number of factors that went into it. For one, the Obama campaign just enjoyed the advantage of not having an active primary context. That meant that they essentially had about a year and a half to develop tools, to staff up, to field test things, to try to engage their supporters online. Whereas the Romney campaign was facing a very volatile primary, they had to spend a lot of money on television advertisements, they had a very small staff comparatively, and they were trying to build technologies while essentially flying their campaign plane, which is a really difficult thing to pull off. But at the same time, I think there was also other differences between the two campaigns, certainly structurally. The Obama campaign, both in 2008 and 2012, made a whole host of organizational decisions that were very important in terms of how they used social media. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the digital division of the 2012 Obama campaign essentially had autonomy to be able to do things like send out tweets in the moment, to script their own social media content, to put up Facebook posts on their own without having to have it vetted by communication staffers and other folks on the campaign.
Okay, that sounds a little dangerous.
It is. It's very dangerous, of course, because, you know, things can be off message, things can be inappropriate, et cetera. But what I think you had was a very dedicated and very smart group of professionals who actually took that freedom. And what they were able to do was actually leverage social media in ways that they were able to respond in the moment to flows of events, because social media users expect instantaneous responses. They're interactional mediums. And second, they're able to respond in appropriate ways, right? Press releases don't travel as far as other types of content online. Journalists and citizens expect certain genres of social media content. So to the extent that the Obama campaign had that freedom to be timely and to be appropriate for the mediums, I think that was an advantage. Whereas I think one of the things that was the case on the Romney campaign was that they didn't have – their digital staffers didn't have the same organizational freedom to be producing content on their own. They had a lot many more layers of vetting that in essence sort of delayed their ability to put out content in the moment. And it certainly delayed as well the sorts of, we would say, the voice that they were able to speak in and to tweet in, et cetera.
So one more question on this topic before we move on. What do you think the picture is going to look like in 2016 for both parties?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of it will depend on who the candidates are. So insurgent candidates in particular tend to be able to use social media in ways that engage and galvanize their supporters. So I think the candidate matters. I think the electoral context matters. How big is the field? I think organizational structures matter a lot. So how do campaigns go out and actually organize their social media divisions, their digital divisions? What role do they see for digital as being part of the campaign itself really matters. And then I also think that in general, you'll see a continuation of a number of trends that we've seen over the last decade, which is to say that media are just far more fragmented than they used to be. So campaigns need to go to where their voters are. And that means advertising across, you know, many different platforms to try to show up in timelines of voters, to try to show up in their Facebook news feeds, as well as on their doorsteps. So it has to be a very integrated strategy. And I think that's what you'll see. I also expect to see, I think we've seen a lot on the Republican side, lots of investment in new staffers, in new technologies. And I think you'll see an increasing parity between the two parties.
So Daniel Kreese, how much does online advertising cost compared to the more traditional methods, newspapers, TV, radio?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. I think one of the big stories is that the cost of online advertising has gone down. It's certainly cheaper to run online advertising. I think a lot of the tools in particular for things like targeting have also fallen. And there's even new self-service technologies. Targeted Victory, which is a Republican consultancy, actually has a self-service program where candidates can go and they can upload voter lists or go with other data providers in order to reach particular subsets of voters and essentially do it on their own. So I think that's falling. And I think that's also increasingly reflecting a reality of online advertising sort of more broadly is cheaper to run than conventional broadcast ads. And I think it's also more efficient, which is to say you're actually able to deliver ads to much more narrower slices of voters.
Sure. So if you would, Forrest, describe in detail Netroots and its influence in shaping voter perception.
The Netroots is more broadly, I think the broader sort of ecosystem that exists around the Democratic Party, which is to say lots of other sites and commentators and influential blogs such as Daily Kos. for example. And it's really sort of the more progressive online wing of the Democratic Party. I think where that matters as sort of an online movement is really in the context of primaries. So the Netroots movement has been very engaged in trying to turn out Democratic voters during primaries to support more progressive candidates, run challenges to more conservative Democratic incumbents, and they raise money, et cetera. So I think the Netroots is sort of you could think of them as an intra-party social movement that's largely taken shape online, includes sites like Daily Kos and MoveOn.org. And I think one of the things that they've been able to do is influence Democratic primary campaigns.
Daniel, we have about a minute left. We've got a comment from a caller. Haven't most voters already made up their minds? Isn't it more of an issue of getting them to the polls? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a great question. I think one of the ways that we see social media is engaging voters who have a certain set of partisan affiliations. So Democrats will use social media to turn out Democrats, particularly in low salience elections that are off year, that don't have the high visibility or high excitement of presidential campaigns. So that's a big way that social media is used. Absolutely. And then, you know, campaigns will fight over that narrow slice of the electorate that is still undecided, that might be less attentive to the news media. And then that's where they're going to really look to use platforms such as Facebook or Pinterest to be able to put their messages in front of those voters and try to figure out what they care about so that they can make those targeted appeals.
Daniel Kreese, it was a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us on Radio Times. Daniel Kreese is an assistant professor of journalism and mass communication at UNC Chapel Hill. And this reminder, you can visit our Facebook page and find our podcasts by heading to our homepage. That's whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us. Hour 2 is coming right up.